Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. Academic scholarships are automatically offered to eligible students upon admission, and all Luther students receive some form of financial aid. Luther.edu.
Support for WPR comes from Stafford Rosenbaum, a Wisconsin-based law firm celebrating 145 years of commitment to practical legal solutions in areas such as family law and estate planning. StaffordLaw.com.
I used to wake up at 4 a.m. and start sneezing, sometimes for 5 hours. I tried to find out what sort of allergy I had, but finally came to the conclusion that it must be an allergy to consciousness. That's a comment by James Thurber. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Dust, ragweed, cats, dogs, and stinging insects, just some of the allergens that make people sneeze and wheeze. What causes allergies? Who's affected? Are more people allergic now than in the past? And what treatments are available? Joining us for those and other questions is Dr. Robert Bush, professor of medicine at the UW-Madison, chief of allergy at the VA hospital, and a specialist in allergies and immunology.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, Emily mentioned some of the things that seem to set people off, but the more you think about it, the more there seem to be, and not all of them very obvious at all. I mean, people who were, you know, allergic to what, wheat and things like that, and really limited in what they can do. How broad a definition is that word, allergy?
Well, as allergists, we deal with a variety of conditions that we call allergic diseases. And among those are allergic rhinitis, which is a common condition, hay fever, that many people experience. And as we move into this month of August, we're going to see a lot of patients complaining of those kind of problems. Asthma may have some allergic basis in some individuals. We see things like eczema, atopic dermatitis that can be aggravated by food and other allergies. Food reactions, bee stings you mentioned, drug allergies, so a variety of conditions. And we often assist other doctors with sinusitis issues and other conditions where the specialist of an allergist or immunologist may be helpful. And in top of that, aside from allergic diseases, we also deal with immunology as another area, but I think we should limit this to the allergic disease today.
Well, I can't help mentioning here that somebody I knew who was allergic to dogs got a dog that she was not supposed to be allergic to, and it turned out, so far as anybody could tell, the dog was allergic to her. I mean, how big a problem is this?
Well, actually, dogs do develop allergies. Their response is somewhat different. It's their skin, so they itch a lot in the fall when they're allergic to ragweed.
Well, let's get a definition of allergy then. Is it just a sort of systemic reaction? Is it what does it actually mean?
Well, the term implies that a person has become sensitized to some foreign substance that their body recognizes being foreign to them, and they develop a particular type of immune response that involves a particular kind of antibody called IgE. And we can test for that by either a skin test or a blood test in many cases to find out exactly what material is causing the reaction.
I think many of us have had those skin tests where you get tested for cat and dog and dust. There's always the sort of control one called histamine.
That's correct. The reaction is somewhat complex in that one has to be exposed to the material at least one time. Often it is genetically controlled. So if someone in your family has had allergies, particularly your parents, one or both, that makes you more likely to develop an allergy. What you become allergic to depends on your environment, what you're exposed to. And these start to develop very early in life in predisposed people. So children as young as 2 years of age and even younger for foods can develop allergy and later on develop the pollens, molds, danders, and so forth. So these person develops the sensitization, meaning they become allergic by making these antibodies, those then attach to various cells, or the cells called mast cells and basophils in our blood, mast cells in our tissues, the eyes, the nose, the respiratory system, the skin, the GI system. So these are the targets for the reaction. So the next time you come in contact with the substance, these cells spew out histamine, as you mentioned, and that is really what produces the reaction and other chemicals involved in that as well. And so the histamine just tells us simply when we test people that they are capable of reacting to our test. We also put on a negative control to make sure that just pricking their skin doesn't cause a reaction. And there are people that even that subtle pricking of the skin will cause histamine to come out in their skin and make a welt like a hive.
Well, let me ask you this, because most of us, if we're, let's say, cleaning out an attic and there's all kinds of dust, we'll start sneezing and we're a little uncomfortable with the dust. In order to be allergic to dust, what has to happen?
Well, it's not the dust particles that are responsible for an allergic reaction. Now, that's not to say that one can't have symptoms from dust particles irritating your nose. And so the thing that causes allergy in dust, particularly in bedding and carpeting, are dust mites, little microscopic critters that you don't see that live in our bedding. We all have them in our homes. We carry them around in our clothing. And so it's the dust mite that we're testing for the allergy to the house dust mite. But if we are negative on that test and the person tells us that dusting makes them sneeze, it's probably an irritation.
So what is the difference between somebody who has a perfectly reasonable, well-functioning immune system and somebody who has an allergy? I mean, aren't we supposed to react in a defensive way to these things?
Well, this is a very important question because it relates to the fact, why do we have this system that makes these antibodies of this type that cause these problems? And it is there basically to protect us, especially from parasites. So people that have parasite infections often will have very high levels of this antibody in their circulation. But often they don't have any allergy because their immune system is doing what it's supposed to be doing. And what we're seeing are reactions to things that are harmless to the vast majority. So it's the subset of people that are the ones that have the allergies and develop these weird and wonderful reactions that allergists take care of.
It seems as if some of the food allergies are the scariest, the peanuts, the shrimp, you know, where people can die. You hear stories where maybe they just kissed somebody who had had peanut butter or whatever. Can you say something about how that is different from a dust allergy?
Well, we see these exposures principally in the airborne things like the pollens, molds, danders, so forth. And then the ingested things like foods, say, for example, bee sting, medications, and those produce a very generalized body reaction throughout your system that we call anaphylaxis, which is a very, very serious, potentially life-threatening type of response, and people can die from those and do.
And if you look at the whole spectrum of allergies, the way one could, with cancer, identify how much breast cancer, lung cancer, sure, and all that. With allergies, if you had a sort of a pie diagram showing the most common and mm-hmm. some of the rare ones, I mean, what are the biggest?
Well,
allergies?
I think by far most people who suffer from the hay fever kind of problems. Up to 20% or so of the U.S. population is affected by that. Asthma, roughly 6%. And there was a comment, I think, about are these things increasing in prevalence? And certainly they seem to be over the last 20, 30 years. And then the anaphylactic reactions are far, far less, but nonetheless are not rare.
So is hay fever some kind of a catch-all for any number of plants that set people off?
Well, when we talk about that, this was the term that we used to describe people that get the sneezing, itchy, watery eyes, runny nose, congestion in the spring and the fall of the year, primarily, maybe in the summer. So that's where that term originated. They thought that originally it was because of hay, and it turns out it's the grass pollen that's in the air. And some people use the term rose fever because they see the roses blooming, or they see something plant that is pollinate. They don't see the pollen. They don't see the pollen. It's invisible. You have to have a microscope to see these things. But, you know, they attributed it to the harvesting the grass, perhaps, and the pollen is circulated, and that's what causes difficulty.
What about ragweed, then?
Well, ragweed, of course, is what we see in the fall, and that is really prevalent here in the upper Midwest. We have two major varieties of the ragweed, the short ragweed, which you often see growing along disturbed ground on the sidewalks, and then the giant ragweed, 10 feet tall or more, that grows along the fields. And the pollen travels 400 miles.
Wow.
So it can go a long, long ways.
Well, I've also heard of people moving to Arizona, for example, to avoid allergies, and then their allergies start to kick in because people like to plant plants that happen to be a problem for them.
Well, you're correct in that this was often the way people tried to escape some of the plants, like the ragweed, that isn't found in abundance in the deserts. But people imported a lot of northern plants that took root, and mulberry trees in particular seemed to be a big one in the Southwest because people planted these things that they had up north, and they became sensitized to those. So I always advise people not to move unless you spend some time there and see how you do.
Well, and that also can happen sometimes with animals where if you have a child who's allergic to cats and so then you get a bird and discover they're also allergic to birds, you know, it can cross animals as well.
Yeah, what happens is because you have a built-in mechanism to develop the sensitivities, you can expand your repertoire if you have exposures over time to things. But usually by late teens, early 20s at the latest probably, most people have developed the sensitivities they're going to continue with. But they could acquire new ones. For example, if a person works in a research laboratory with a lot of rats and mice and had cat allergy, then they're going to have more trouble in those facilities than others.
Well, then I have to ask you about something because one of our children was tested as allergic to cats. And at that point, we had 5 cats in the home. And she now, at the age of 20, about 11 years later, tested as no longer allergic to cats, which kind of brings up this question that you sometimes hear tossed around. Can you actually get over an allergy? And is sometimes being exposed to something helpful rather than harmful?
Well, I think there are 2 points here. Number one, aging, as it's the only good thing I know about aging, is that our hay fever symptoms often abate as we approach our 40s and beyond. So often those symptoms will disappear, even though a person may still have a positive skin test to the material.
Is that because your immune system is
It just doesn't
out?
Work as well, you know, so that's good news in this case, but for other things it's not. But that is one thing that happens. And secondly, you mentioned you had a number of pets, and we know that there are people, particularly children, who are born in environments where there's a cat. And if you have a number of these animals, there seems to be what we call a tolerance that develops. And even though they test positive, they are not bothered as long as they have this high exposure. But often what happens is they go to college away from home, not exposed to cats, come back for the Thanksgiving break, and are totally miserable. So that tolerance is a factor that we're recognizing now as part of the equation and involves a little bit different immune response and so forth. But you keep it going by the exposure. And then once you're away from that, that part goes away and the allergy remains.
Is that true, too, of something like cigarette smoke?
Well, cigarette smoke, again, I classify as an irritation. It's not a true allergy. And most people, if they get enough exposure, are going to complain that that makes their nose plug up and their nose run and their eyes water. So these are irritations. So that's what we try to distinguish an irritation from an allergy. And by talking with patients, we can often get an idea which it may be. And then we test them to find out for sure on those things that would we expect to show up on a skin test or blood test.
Well, let's say you have someone who is allergic to cats show up at a house with cats. And you can see progressively the eyes start to water, the nose gets a little red. There's sort of this time span before you get absolutely miserable. Can you kind of tell us what it is that's happening, you know, to that person who enters a home with cats?
Surely. Well, my wife's a prime example. So basically, when you are exposed to the material from the cat that's in the air, You breathe it in. It winds up in your nose and your eyes, and you can breathe in your lungs. If you have asthma, it can make that worse too. But these symptoms occur very, very rapidly. And this is what we call the immediate response, meaning this IgE system is working. So when you skin test someone within 10, 15 minutes, you see the reaction occurring miniature in the skin, and that occurs very rapidly. Now, if you no longer are exposed, say you leave the environment, you're not there, you left the room and went home, and what happens? Well, 4 to 6 hours later, you can have the problem start all over again. And we call this the late phase reaction, which is a bit different in that it involves histamine, but there are cells in the circulation that now are attracted into the tissue to cause that. And that takes a bit of time. And so that you have possibility of a person with asthma or hay fever going to bed and waking up middle of the night with their symptoms again, even though they hadn't been exposed. So that's a different arm in the whole system, and it requires a different approach, and we use this in our therapy.
What kind of a therapy would you use then?
Well, I think most people are familiar with antihistamines. And so those are available over the counter. For example, we have the loratadine Claritin type of non-sedating medication. We have the standard old Benadryl, diphenhydramine, chlorotrimetine, chlorpheniramine, a number of these antihistamines. Now we have these newer ones that are by prescription that also are non-sedating. But their role in the treatment of allergic disease is somewhat limited because they only affect sneezing and itching. They do not deal very effectively with the congestion, the drainage, and these late reactions that occur. They just don't touch those.
When we talk about these animal allergies, am I right in assuming that you're actually breathing in little fragments of dried skin? Is that what the irritant is?
The actual material is, in most cases, for most allergic reactions, some form of a protein that is found. And as you mentioned, it appears, at least with a cat, that the material can be found in their saliva. So they lick themselves to clean themselves. That gets stuck to their hair, and then they shed their skin like we all do. And around the hair follicle, there's material that's secreted onto the hair. And it's flakes of those that get airborne. And they can be in various sized particles. Some are very, very small, and some are somewhat larger. So the importance of this is that comparing dust mites to cat, the dust mite allergy material is relatively heavy. It doesn't stay in the air long, so you can't clean it out with an air cleaner, for example. And so you get exposed to the dust mites. When you hit the bed, it goes in the air, settles back down real quick. On the other hand, a cat, the stuff's all over the carpet, so on and so forth. You walk in the room, it goes up in the air, and it stays there because it's a fine particle and remains suspended, so you can breathe it far longer.
Without even necessarily being aware that you're smelling it?
You don't have to smell it, no.
Well, and how long does it stay there? Let's say you move into an apartment that a cat owner had.
Yes.
How long until?
Yes. Well, it does take a long time to decay to the level where there's no level that's detectable or beyond what you normally would find. And that's the other point. A cat allergen is virtually everywhere. We carry it around in our clothing, so if you have cats, any place where there's a carpet, there's going to be cat dander. Schools, places where you've never had a cat, you can find cat dander. But the other question is, this is a very sticky material, electrically static charged, and it sticks to walls. And it takes 6 months from the time the cat is gone for it to decay to a level.
And is that different from dogs or horses?
Well, we haven't studied those quite as extensively as we have the cat, but perhaps some of those things are true of those animals as well.
It seems that people with cat allergies have worse allergies than
the
others.
Yeah, they seem to be bothered quite a bit, and often those people have difficulty around horses as well.
We're going to talk more about allergies, including allergies to food, and what you can do about it when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
WPR.org has lots of great features for you to use. If you'd like to give feedback about this program or others, log on to WPR.org and click on Listener Feedback. Thank you for listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Dr. Robert Bush, and we're talking about allergies. One of the things I've read about is the hygiene hypothesis, that you actually can make things worse by being overly clean.
Well, that's true. I saw in an article, eat dirt. that may be healthy for you if you want to prevent allergy. What Emily is referring to is the fact that in many parts of the world, when we look at the areas that are underdeveloped, there seems to be less allergy than the more developed areas. And those people are subjected to lots of different infections, which kind of tilts your immune system away from allergy. Now, as a child is born, they are actually skewed, as we call it, toward developing allergy unless something changes the course. Genetics plays into that, but examples are you have a person who may be susceptible to developing allergy, but if that person gets repeated viruses or other infections early in life, they don't go on to develop as many allergies. And pets may be a factor too. We've talked about the cat and the tolerance to that. But actually, in some studies, particularly my colleague at the university, Dr. Lemansky, has been looking at children with potential of developing allergies and asthma. And having a dog in the house may prevent the development of allergies and asthma. So dog may truly be man's best friend. So if you are a parent and are having a child and you have allergies, maybe getting a dog is a good idea. But anyway, that's sort of the hygiene hypothesis. We've seen this at work in Germany where the East and West reunited. East Germany had very little allergy. West Germany had a lot more. And now that East Germany is catching up, they're getting more allergies there. So it's a factor that our immune system needs some kind of stimulation that doesn't lead us to develop these crazy things.
It's almost as if the immune system is just looking for something to do. So it says,
yeah,
well,
exactly.
Okay, let's just do this.
Exactly. And if you have the right genetics, even more so.
Well, could it be, though, that pollutants play a role, like with West Germany? I mean, that you if you become more industrialized, you also have
well,
more.
Well, East Germany was
polluted. You're actually correct. East had more pollution than the West.
Yeah.
So I think they've determined that a lot of this has to do with your infectious rates. And you see this in kids in daycare, that if they're exposed to a lot of infections in the first 6 months or so of life in daycare, they're less likely to have allergies.
What about farm kids?
Well, farmers too. It's supposedly true that farm communities, there's less allergy than in the urban area. Again, depending on your exposure, you're exposed to a lot of organisms on the farm from the animal droppings. Perhaps that has something to do with the dogs too. They're bigger than the cat and have more bacteria that they can shed in the environment.
Is there a kind of a change at puberty vis-a-vis allergies?
Often what we see are children that start out with asthma earlier in life. As they reach puberty, they may have less difficulty. It may go into remission for asthma, for example, for a period of time. But often in the 30s age group, they're coming back again. So it doesn't get rid of it entirely, but some people, quote, outgrow their asthma at least for a period of time.
Does it ever work the other way? Let's say if you grow up with cats and then by the time you're 11 or 12, you might become allergic to them?
Well, it's theoretically possible, but as I mentioned, you know, your exposure has a lot to do with it. And so often, you know, around the puberty in that time frame, you've already acquired most of your allergies.
Well, let's talk about food allergies because there are people allergic to all kinds of different food.
Sure.
And I guess you mentioned that one of the reasons we might have this kind of reaction in general is because our body thinks it's a parasite. I could see that if it's something like a dust mite or cat saliva or whatever. But why would we have evolved so that some people would be allergic to, let's say, wheat?
Well, that's a perfectly good question, too. As you know, here in the U.S., we consider peanut as the principal allergy material. Often in adults, we see shellfish, particularly shrimp. And then depending on where you are in the world, other things may predominate, such as codfish in Scandinavia, rice in Japan. So these tend to be in part is in your diet. But I had a colleague who's an expert in food allergy tell me that he thought the reason peanut was a problem is the fact that there are sugars on the peanut protein that resemble parasites as well. So again, the genetics that lead you to have a good defense against parasites may be turned against you, and you develop these reactions to things that shouldn't cause reaction.
Your system is just misidentifying.
Yes. I think that's in part, you know, an explanation. We don't have proof positive, but as we learn more and more about what are the constituents within various things that are related to the allergy, we find that there are things cropping up. As you mentioned, dust mites, here are some things with parasites, rat urine, amazingly, and the foods that I mentioned. So there's a variety of pieces of evidence that suggest that's probably what's going on.
Well, let's say I'm a person with a peanut allergy, and you hand me a peanut butter cookie, and I take a bite. Can you trace what is going to happen to me and why?
Well, it's pretty likely that if you're sensitive to that, that would be a very significant reaction. So again, you absorb the proteins from the food, circulates through your body, gets to these cells we talked about, the mast cells, basophils. Histamine comes pouring out very quickly. You can go into shock. You can get dizzy, lightheaded. Your blood pressure goes down. Your heart rate generally goes up. You get itchy all over, perhaps, break out in welts, swelling. You could have stomach upset, vomiting, diarrhea.
And what would you do?
Well, immediately we would give you epinephrine, adrenaline, because that's the life-saving treatment. So anyone who's had a history of similar type of reaction, we make sure that they know how to use an EpiPen, we call it, or a similar thing to treat the reaction immediately. Don't wait till you're sick, but even in an inkling is what has to be done to prevent a fatality.
And this would be the same, or you'd have a reaction to some extent, even if you, say, had somebody breathe peanut breath on you, or
well,
if you were,
you know,
in contact otherwise?
That's a good question that we're trying to figure out. What's the amount that a person can tolerate? And we've actually done studies. I've conducted these at the university as part of a consortium where we have peanut allergic people come in and give them infinitesimally small doses of peanut to see what happens and just give them a little bit more till they first feel it. And interestingly, when we did that, very few people could truly identify when they actually got peanut compared to a placebo. But there is a threshold at some level, and it is quite small, particularly for food reactions. So best is avoidance. It's kind of unlikely that if a person breathed on you, that would do it. But perhaps, you know, they'd eaten something and you kiss them, as Emily pointed out. There have been reports that may happen. And in fact, we're doing a study right now to see how much of the peanut protein is expressed in the saliva when people eat peanuts. These are non-allergic people, but they can eat the peanut, and then we measure how much of the protein gets in their saliva.
Now, if you have someone who's lactose intolerant, that isn't exactly an allergy, is it, or does it count as one?
Well, we see patients who may have conditions such as that. The intolerance means that a person, in the case of this lactose, they lack an enzyme in their intestine that allows them to digest and absorb the sugar in milk. So if we talk about a person who has a problem when they eat, I prefer, at least initially, to call it an adverse reaction. It doesn't say how it happens. It just is simply you eat something, it bothers you. And of the reactions, there are intolerances, which are the vast majority. This means that there's an identifiable case in milk sugar, but in other times, there is no real mechanism that we have identified. And then with allergy, it's a small subset of people, 1 to 2% of adults, up to 6% of kids.
What percent of adults have some kind of allergy?
To food, 1 to 2%.
But in general?
This, is, again, those, as Emily mentioned, like to peanut, shrimp, milk, different foods like that. Now, in children, often they will develop a milk or egg allergy early in life. And as time goes by, they lose that sensitivity. So to see true milk or egg allergy persisting into adulthood is relatively rare. We see peanuts that last many times through your lifetime. You develop as a child because your mom feeds you peanut butter. And so that's with you the rest of your time probably. Shrimp maybe a little later as we, you know, increase our diet and take in things that kids don't eat a lot of.
It does make me wonder a little bit, you know, can you can you live for 30, 40, 50 years before you discover you have some terrible allergy to something that you hadn't encountered before?
That's pretty unlikely, you know.
You're going to get it early on somehow.
You know, your 40s and then new things are not likely to appear. So if you've escaped probably through your teens and 20s of having allergies, you're pretty unlikely to go on and get them later.
Can we talk about allergies to drugs and medicines? Yeah. Because that also can be a pretty scary thing when somebody is allergic to penicillin or to some other.
This is true. The reactions are very, very similar to what I described with peanut. The person immediately can go into shock and have all the other things that I mentioned. Fortunately, we can test patients to determine if they are sensitive, if there's a need for a penicillin. Obviously, if you can avoid it and take something else that doesn't bother you, that's the first line of treatment. But we are consulted quite regularly about patients in the hospital who have serious illnesses, may need penicillin, and we test and find out if they have a risk for a reaction. Occasionally, we may have to actually give them penicillin, even if they're allergic, because we have no other choice. And in that case, we do a little thing called a desensitization, which means we give them very, very tiny amount in gradually increase it every 10, 15 minutes. If they react, we treat it and keep going. And eventually they tolerate it. Now, when they finish that, once they're off that treatment, 4 or 5 days later, they're back to square one. So it's not a lifetime treatment. It's just to get them through the therapy they need.
And is the penicillin reaction partly because it's kind of like mold?
Well, it's not the mold necessarily. It's actually part of the drug that is responsible. And so it's derived from a mold, but that has nothing to do with penicillin allergy. There is the mold Penicillium, which can grow primarily indoors. It's the moldy bread mold sometimes. And people become allergic to the spores or the allergens that are in the air from that kind of thing. And that we often test on our skin test. But that is different from the drug.
So I gather you get maybe a different set of allergies in the winter, say when houses are all sealed up.
Surely. Well, during the winter months, actually the dust mite population decreases significantly. Dust mites like high humidity. So as we turn on our heat and get very dry in the winter in Wisconsin, 20% relative humidity perhaps, there are very few dust mites thriving in that environment. As we get into spring and we're turning the heat off and it's cool and we're not running the air conditioner, open the windows, all the humidity comes in, those dust mites love it. And so I tell people if you're allergic to dust mites, you want to keep the humidity below 50%. You may need to put in moisture in the winter to help your nose because your nose gets dry and irritated from the dry air. But beside dust mite, the only thing that would be in the winter primarily would be pets and possibly if you have a water leak and you have some mold inside. But that's about it.
I've heard of people who also have allergies to various chemicals like latex, for example, or certain things that they either touch or, you know, like, for example, a doctor wearing latex gloves.
Yes. Well, that became a real problem in the era of the HIV infection. So everyone is wearing gloves in the hospital setting to avoid infectious transmission of agents. So latex became a very common problem, particularly in healthcare workers and in people that undergo a lot of surgeries. And they actually become sensitized to a material that's in the latex. And again, it's testable by skin test or blood test and telling people to avoid that when they have surgery and carry a warning, let their physicians know that this is possible. And so this is a real common problem, but it's abating a bit because the manufacturers now have improved the quality of the gloves so they don't have as much of that material in them anymore.
But overall, we're seeing more allergies than we were 50 years ago?
Yes, that's certainly true in terms of asthma and these other conditions as well. And again, whether it relates to the improved sanitation, this hygiene hypothesis, it's hard to know for sure.
Are we identifying some things as allergies that we didn't previously know?
Well, a classic example, you may have seen the multicolor Asian lady beetles
yes,
in your
indeed.
Homes. Those were imported to the U.S., I think around 1900, if I'm not mistaken, to combat pests on plants. Well, they did extremely well. They overgrew. They took over the native lady beetles. And so they're really, really common here in the upper Midwest. They get in your homes, and people have started becoming allergic to those. And it's only been, I think, noticeable in the last several years. And a colleague of mine described a patient he had seen who had a building that was just covered with these things. So he was cleaning out this building and in the process started wheezing and having bad asthma. So he asked the fellow to bring in some of the beetles, crushed them up, skin tested him. He had a huge reaction. So we've been looking at this in our laboratory, and one of my colleagues claimed that the Asian lady beetle allergy is the first new indoor allergen described in the past 25 years. So it spread not just in the Midwest, but the South, the Northeast, where these insects are found, you have a potential of becoming allergic. So that is a new one.
More on allergies when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
WPR.org has lots of great features for you to use. If you'd like to give feedback about this program or others, log on to WPR.org and click on Listener Feedback. Thank you for listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Robert Bush, who is telling us about allergies. And what you heard there was no less than an orchestral sneeze. It's quite famous, actually. It's from Harajanish by Zoltán Kodály, and it, in Hungarian folklore, implies that what is to follow is true. So we think it's appropriate for University of the Year in particular.
We certainly hope so.
What about a situation in which you have somebody from another part of the world coming to the United States? What do they have to cope with most likely?
Well, it's interesting. We have an ethnic diversity populace here in Madison. And so students, particularly that come from the Far East, stay here. And the first year in the August-September months, they're fine. But the second year, they have absolutely miserable time with hay fever from the ragweed. And whether this is, again, a genetic predisposition, which may well be, but they don't have the ragweed to contend with in Far East, unless it starts taking hold there eventually.
It's
but
a
right
fair
now,
swap
it's not,
for those beetles that they sent us.
Yeah, well, perhaps. But as I say, you know, it's this international things that occur. People traveling, they're sending in plants, and they get taking hold in some place in the world. People are allergic there, and it may get here to us and vice versa. So I think, again, it's the predisposition that one has and then what one is exposed to and why ragweed more so than anything else.
And their future, their prospects are just to take some kind of antihistamine every August or September for the rest of their lives that they're here?
Well, there may be several approaches. As I say, these people are often quite miserable. Our treatment, the antihistamines, as I said before, to simply help sneezing itching. And to get the maximum effect, one has to take those regularly during the season. Otherwise, they don't work very well. They actually block the histamine effect rather than taking away what's there. We often will prescribe nasal sprays that contain a form of cortisone. Everyone cringes at that word, but cortisone in this case, it is a very, very minute dose. It is applied to the nose, so it doesn't really go anywhere beyond that. The only issue is one has to take that regularly, at least during the season, and it may take a few days or more for it to have an effect. So we generally try to start it actually before the season. There's data suggests that that may work better than waiting until you're miserable. So anyway, they go through the season, they can stop it, but it usually doesn't cause many effects. However, if they're going to be spending time in the future, we can go through our old allergy shots, as they say, where we inject the person with the pollen material to desensitize them. And that's a bit different than I talked about on the penicillin end. This will impart a long-term reduction in the symptoms and skew, again, the immune system away from making these antibodies that are causing it. And over 3 to 4 years of therapy, one may encounter then a long-term effect. And we're working on a number of different approaches to simplify that, meaning that some people will get maybe 6 injections, and that's all it takes the rest of their life instead of weekly and
over
monthly
the course
for
of
4 or 5 years.
Period of time will those 6 be?
in 6 weeks. Weekly shot for 6 weeks. These are investigational right now. Hopefully, it'll be available in the future for ragweed in particular. And then we're also thinking about drops under the tongue using the European system, where a very high dose of the material is applied to the mouth. And it seems to be quite safe. Person could do this at home. And then the other approach is maybe a tablet that one swallows with ragweed in it. The side effects of these seem to be minimal. So I think they're safe. If they turn out to be effective and safe, hopefully we can do this in the future and make life much easier for our patients and ourselves.
There's not going to be a dog or cat pill, though?
Well, eventually there may be. Now, as you may know, they've actually tried to breed a hypoallergenic cat. Mm-hmm. If you have $3,000 to spend on one,
you're
welcome.
They're kind of ugly, aren't they?
I would imagine. I have no idea what they look like.
I heard there was a waiting list.
Sure there is. A lot of people need that.
I knew of one woman where she was allergic to dust, so her husband had to do all the vacuuming, which seemed like a convenient thing. Are there differences between men and women in how they respond to allergens?
Not really. There is no real distinct difference. Some people may have more susceptibility to these irritations that we talked about. One can only wear a mask to avoid the exposure, say, if you're dusting, for example. And if a person's allergic, that may help to some degree. And again, trying to avoid what bothers you is really a key principle if you can. Now, certainly the pollens, that's not possible if you want to spend any time whatsoever outdoors. So we have to be able to provide people with treatments that will allow them to effectively be out of doors.
And do you think a lot of businesses sort of capitalize on this by putting the term hypoallergenic on everything and selling all kinds of expensive air filters that don't work?
Well, I think one has to be a little cautious. It really seems that the best way to approach it is to identify the source of the allergy. And there have been studies in children in inner city environments that have asthma, and they are sensitized to things like the cockroaches, the dust mites, the cats. Parents may smoke, a number of things that could affect them. So they've designed what they call safe rooms for the children so that they have air cleaner if there's particulate matter like smoke or things in the air that can be filtered, cat allergen, for example. So you need to know what the target is in order to be able to do this cost effectively. One cannot simply put on a mattress cover and pillow encasement to get rid of dust mite sensitivity because it's in the carpet and you have to control humidity. So you have to do a variety of things depending on what the allergy is.
What if I'm a parent of a small child, you know, a neonate, and I don't necessarily have any allergic history or awareness of it in the family, but what if I'm terribly concerned about, gosh, what if the baby is allergic to peanuts or something like that? I mean, is there any way to pre-screen for those things? Is it done?
Well, at the present time, as I mentioned, my colleague, Dr. Lemansky, is doing studies on children. But these are people that are predisposed. Mm-hmm. One or both parents have allergies or asthma. So they're in the high-risk group, as we call it. For the ordinary parent who doesn't have allergy, neither parent has allergies, there's no family history thereof, I don't think there's any real precautions that we advise, except perhaps avoiding exposure to peanuts early in life until the child's a little older. You know, that might prevent some of that development. But it's usually the predisposed group that is most likely to have difficulty when they're exposed to things like the peanut early in life and so forth.
Make sure they get enough dirt.
Yeah, need dirt. Exactly. Get a lot of infections.
Are there people with asthma who have no allergies at all, or is it pretty much always the case that someone with asthma has allergies?
Well, that's a good question. One can develop asthma virtually any point in life. I have seen patients who developed it in their 80s who never had any problems prior to that. But on the other hand, many of the people we see, it does begin as a child. They may go into remission, as I mentioned, between puberty and, say, 30. Then it's back again for the rest of their life. So those people that have it early in life typically are allergic to something initially, or that plays into it and may have some bearing. But later in life, often you will see people that don't have any positive skin tests, blood tests, or any identifiable allergy.
We occasionally hear, and it seems to be mostly in people like middle ages and older who come down with hives or even shingles as a reaction to something.
Well, the shingles is actually the chickenpox virus that has come back to haunt you. But the chronic hives are a not uncommon condition. About 20% of people in the U.S. at least once in their life get a case of hives. Usually it goes away and that's it. And often these can occur around the time of a respiratory infection, perhaps. Often medications get blamed when it may not be that. But then on the other hand, we see people who get these hives and swelling their lips and face, and it goes day after day after day, and they're totally miserable. And it seems to affect women more than men, but you see it in both sexes. And the cause of that in the vast majority of cases is unknown. It is not necessarily something you eat, breathe, touch. But these cells in the skin are setting off this histamine release and other chemicals, and it just keeps going and going and going. Now, in the last 3 months, we have a blood test that may shed some light on this. Again, we've talked about antibodies and allergic reactions. Well, in the hive patient, the IgE itself is not necessarily the problem. There's an antibody that attaches directly to the mast cells in the skin that sets it off. And this is what we call an autoantibody. Other examples of that, there are a number of people that develop low thyroid function because they have an antibody in their circulation that destroys the thyroid gland. And often the two go hand in hand. So we'll often see a patient with hives and they have problems with their thyroid. We do the test on the blood for the thyroid antibody and it's positive. And we think, well, maybe give them a little thyroid medication will help their hives. Yeah, I'm not convinced it does. Some of my colleagues do, but it's not real hard science in my opinion. But I think that's a marker for this other condition. And now we have a test and I've seen people with both. And I think, you know, that kind of explains it, helps the patient understand it's not what you're breathing, it's not what you're touching, it's not anything at all that's outside of you, it's within you. It does not change your therapy right now, but eventually it will.
Since you said there's a link between allergies and immunology, that, yeah, that we're sort of mimicking what we do to get rid of some kind of foreign substance, if you have a patient, like a cancer patient, who's immunosuppressed, do allergies then actually lessen?
Well, it's actually been studied that if you have allergies sometimes and you're getting all these medications that generally knock out the immune system in some fashion, that perhaps some of the allergic problems will be better. It's not a recommended way to go, of course, right, but we want to target the particular issues that we have at hand, but certainly can do that.
And which people within the population do you find are most at risk for allergies? You know, if you look at the entire American population.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I say, it's not any discriminating factor other than the fact that if you're a person who comes from a family with allergies, you're more likely. What I found fascinating, too, is the fact that if you look at workers who go to work in the research laboratories, we talked a bit about that, 20% of those folks become allergic, whether they have a family history or not. Okay? And so
become allergic to the rats, you mean?
They become allergic to rats and mice. And it's the urine from the male rat that's the culprit. And it has this chemical protein that is like a parasite. So if you're allergic beforehand, then you're 3 to 4 times more likely to become sensitized to the rat and mouse. Okay, you didn't have it when you went in, but a couple months, year or two later, you have it. And so why these 20%, some that have allergy, 3 to 4 times more likely, those that don't get it, and then 80% don't. Again, I think it has to do with the genetics and your programming, so that those people that develop the sensitivity are the ones that probably can fight the parasites the best. And so they're the people that have been selected over the ages, you know, and they survived and their genes got carried through. And therefore, that may have something to do with it. I think that's ultimately the key, is looking into those kind of questions, looking specifically genetics and responses to certain issues. And as we learn more about the chemistry of these different things that cause allergy, we're finding these links more and more.
How low on the animal chain do you have to go to find an allergic creature? And you know, you mentioned that there's a dog.
That's an excellent question. We know the primates for sure. dogs for sure.
I have some mice I could send you because I'm pretty sure they have allergic reactions.
You can make animals sensitive. And again, there are certain strains of these animals that seem to be easier to make allergic. So we use those models in our research, and others that are more resistant. And there are what are called brown Norway rats that are easily sensitized. They actually behave like kids. They have this propensity to develop allergies early in life and may outgrow it as time goes by. And another strain called the Fisher, mean rats. Brown Norway are docile. But the Fisher rats are very difficult to sensitize. So clearly there are animal populations that can be sensitized, and who knows if they're sensitized in the wild, but we do it in a research laboratory.
Yeah, it almost implies from what you say that there's some kind of a correlation between how wild they are and how likely, again, they are to get
a... I don't know how the aggressiveness relates to that fact, but it's interesting. So, as I said, these animals can be used as ways to examine the immune responses to things. And we know that as the immune system matures, as we call it, from repeated infections, what have you, that then they become more resistant to the development of allergies.
Is there a psychological component? You know, in the children's book, The Secret Garden, there's a character, Colin, who won't go out without his mask and he's afraid of spores. And you get the sense that to be healthier, he just needs to quit being afraid of the world.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think some people have the misconception that if you're allergic, say, to a cat, you go in someone's home and immediately start to sneeze. You may not smell the cat. You may not see the cat. You know it's there if you're allergic. So that's not a psychological effect at all. However, there are, as anyone, conditioning responses that occur. And one of the examples was a patient who had hay fever, thought it was the roses that bothered the person, went into a psychiatrist's office, had a vase of roses, immediately started sneezing. So that was, again, a psychological condition, not a true
allergy.
Especially
if they were plastic roses.
Right. And I think it's important to remember that the pollens that affect us are invisible, and the flowering plants in general are pollinated by insects. So those pollens typically, unless you're sticking your nose right in the plant, aren't going to bother you because it's carried insect plant to plant.
Safer from pollen in the city than you would be in the country? Is that too obvious, or is it not so true?
As we mentioned, not really, because people have taken a ship in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and found some of the pollens 400 miles offshore. So often what we see is downwind effect from Minnesota, not Wisconsin.
You could be in St. Louis and still get it.
And it's interesting, this spring, as I was watching the pollen counts this spring, we had a nice early spring day or two, and we saw these pollens. Well, they weren't native plants. These are coming on the wind from south of us. And then those disappeared and our own pollens appear. So we got whammed from two different directions there in the spring.
Any last words for people who are miserably allergic?
Well, I think that certainly seeing a physician if you're having significant symptoms is worth your while. One can try the over-the-counter medications and see if they're effective and tolerated. But beyond those, one really has to consider probably seeing a physician, getting proper diagnosis and treatment. We see a lot of people that have this irritant type of problem. They don't have any positive skin tests. They have congestion, drainage any time of the year, worse with odors, dust, smoke, so forth, the irritation. So there's not a heck of a lot you can do because we don't really have very specific treatment, but some of our medications can help both allergies and this kind of condition as well.
Dr. Robert Bush, thanks for joining us for this hour. I feel better already.
Thank you so much.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. Thanks for joining us. Hope you can be with us for the next hour of University of the Year. Over the years, they influenced each other, and the results are still being debated. Radio, and later television, in England and in America. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 as we have a look at them, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.